A matter of luck. A program dedicated to the greatest inventor and scientific discoverer the world has known, Lady Luck, and bringing you in one complete 30-minute presentation two authentic and true stories of remarkable scientific achievement. Tonight, we tell you of Francis Pettit Smith and Charles Martin Hall, and how each became famous through A Matter of Luck. Francis Pettit Smith and A Matter of Luck. Many a man has plodded along a furrow made for him by others or by necessity, though his heart has been a million dreams away, lost in a magic world called If I Only Had a Chance. Francis Pettit Smith was such a man. As a farmer, he certainly plodded his furrow. He certainly had his dreams. And for a farmer, they were strange ones, for he dreamed of ships, ships that moved against the wind, against the tides. Though he knew that in that year of 1835, ships did move against wind and tide by means of great paddles turned by steam engines, his dreams were of a means of propulsion which would do away entirely with the dangerous, fragile, and inefficient paddles and give to a ship a silent, concealed, and almost secret way upon the water. And then one day in 1835, Francis Pettit Smith returned from market with a stranger and an air of great excitement.
Come in, man. Sit down. Here, take this chair by my desk. You can see better.
Thank you kindly, Mr. Smith.
Give me your hat. That's it. Now, take a look at that drawing in front of you, Mr. Glencannon.
Hmm? Well. By way of being a designer of wee ships, Mr. Smith.
A bit rough and ready, I'm afraid. If I'd only become an engineer like you instead of a farmer, by now my ships might be in every ocean of the world.
There's still time, if you've got the right ideas.
What a stroke of luck it was, meeting my friend Bailey in town, and you with him. For months I've wanted to discuss my ideas with a trained engineer, and to think that I...
Well, let's take a look at what you got here. Well, Mr. Smith, what's this you got? No paddles in your design. And what's this corkscrew affair you've got sticking out at the back?
That's it. That's the whole idea, don't you see? I've discarded the paddles and replaced them with an Archimedes screw.
Shades of Jimmy Watt. Next you'll be telling me that the thing works.
It does.
Have you tried it? Have you built a ship fitted with one of these and tried it?
No, I haven't. Not yet. But others have.
Then how do you know it'll work?
Because only 7 years ago, a ship fitted with an Archimedes screw did work. I'm not an inventor, Mr. Glencannon. I'm only correctly applying, I hope, the discoveries of others. Mainly those of a man named Joseph Ressel. Ressel had the most damnable luck of any man. He hit upon the idea in 1828 and took his plans to a shipbuilder named Ottavio Fontana in Trieste.
Yes, well, of course, my dear Russell, you have not hit on anything new here, have you?
No, senor, nor do I claim to have. But while Bernoulli in 1753 Fitch in 1786 and Delisle in 1814 all went as far as making an Archimedes screw-driven ship. I am the first to apply mathematics to the subject and decide on the best possible shape and size and pitch of the screw.
And very well done, too, my dear fellow. Please do not think I wish to belittle your work. Far from it. I am very impressed. Would it be too much to run over your plans again before I make up my mind?
Very well, senor. Now, we begin here. Mm-hmm. This drawing shows the ship's stern with the spindle protruding through it. So?
Yes.
You know how the screw of Archimedes worked. It was like a huge wood ogre. Archimedes turned his screw to raise water. My screw, attached to the spindle and turned by the steam engine within the ship, will bore its way through the water as an ogre does through wood. And the ship will move rapidly ahead.
Yes, yes. Very sound. Very sound indeed. Herr Russell, my mind is made up. I shall invest money and build your ship, and I have every confidence in it.
You will not regret it. That I promise.
Good. A bottle of Chianti to seal the bargain, eh?
Chianti? Certainly.
There is one thing I would like to ask you, Russell. How is it that no screw-driven ships have ever been successful before?
Because we had not the proper engines. Until James Watt gave us the steam engine, Watt was to turn our screws, eh? A screw must turn rapidly, or instead of propelling a ship, it merely thrashes the water.
Oh, si. Yes, of course. Well, now to our Chianti.
And did this Mr. Fontana really put money into the scheme?
Yes. He built Russell a ship at Trieste, a small but shapely craft with a 6-horsepower engine. But before she could be tried out, permission had to be obtained from the Austrian port police. They gave their consent grudgingly, and at last came the day for testing. The vessel started off, but had only gone a few hundred yards when there was an alarming explosion and she came to a stop. Her steam pipe had blown out.
Did they fix it?
Yes, but unfortunately the Trieste port police wouldn't give permission for a second trial. They considered the new ship too dangerous.
So what happened, man?
Nothing. Except that Fontana withdrew from the scheme. All that remains now is Russell's calculations. And it's on these that I've designed my screw.
Aye. For a foreigner, he seems to have had a wee bit of brains in his head.
We'll build the screw exactly as he laid down. But we'll make it larger to take the greater power of the engines we're going to use.
Mr. Smith, I followed your very lucid explanations remarkably clearly, but one thing puzzles me. When you refer to we, when you say we'll build and we'll make and we're going to use, to whom does the plural apply?
Why, to me and you, man. That is, if you're interested. You're an engineer. I'm not. These drawings are only rough. You can do them properly. You can supervise the building of both the ship and the screw.
The building of what ship?
Why, the one the Admiralty will authorize me to build.
Have you discussed with them yet?
No, but I shall. The very week the plans are ready. What do you say, Mr. Glencannon? Are you with me?
Well, any man who's already planning to build a ship with Admiralty money before they've even seen the plans is such an optimist I cannot resist him. Aye, Mr. Smith, I'm with you.
For once, the Admiralty showed immediate interest and authorized Francis Pettit Smith to build the ship. It was a very small vessel of only 6 tons, but it was a success. The Admiralty's report was so favorable that Smith was able to form a company having sufficient capital to build a ship of 237 tons fitted with new and powerful engines. The great day of the new ship's trial drew near, the day that was to go down in the history of ships purely through a matter of luck. The Archimedes was ready at Portsmouth with Pettit Smith and a party of naval officers aboard. The day was fine and calm, and Glencannon, the engineer, was confident that his engines would perform faultlessly.
Well, Mr. Smith, the weather's holding for you.
Yes, indeed, sir.
You can start as soon as you like. Now, be clear on one thing, Mr. Smith. If your ship can do 5 knots, then we'll take her over and give you a contract for others. But quite frankly, I can't see her doing more than two knots.
Shall I order her away? Then we'll see for ourselves.
Very well. Full sail ahead.
Then cannon. Full steam.
Aye, Mr. Smith.
I must congratulate you, Mr. Smith. Your ship handles very well. Very well indeed. What's our speed?
5 knots, sir.
Well, you've exceeded our expectations by a handsome margin. Well done, sir.
Hey, what's going on?
What the devil's that?
Mr. Smith, I'll have to shut the engine down. There's something amiss with the screw.
All right, Glencannon. Close her down.
So your screw has broken down, eh? Well, maybe we were satisfied too soon.
It's my opinion, sir, we've struck an obstruction underneath the stern. I'm going overboard to see for myself once I get my clothes off.
Very well, Glencannon, but don't take any risks.
This is very fortunate for the Admiralty, Mr. Smith, this mishap. We'd quite overlooked the possibility of damage to the screw.
Yes, it may be fortunate for you, sir. But it's a bitter blow to me.
What I don't get stuck under the ship, sir?
All right, Glencannon.
Here I go.
By gad, the fellow swims like a fish, doesn't he?
Mr. Smith, sir. A log of wood or something is sucked into the screw and has broken more than half of it off.
Well, that's the end of our test.
The end of our interest in screws, Mr. Smith. Well, I suppose we'd better signal for help. Well, it's just as I've always said. Can't beat a bit of sail and a good stiff breeze from the southwest.
But Smith didn't care for the indignity of being towed back to port. And when the engineer climbed on board, he received certain instructions whispered in his ear by a crestfallen but still stubborn Mr. Smith.
Listen, Glencannon. I'm not going to be towed back to Portsmouth if I can help it. Start the engine. A little bit of screw that's left may just get us back with our dignity.
Aye, it might, but I doubt it. Still, I'll go and try.
Why, Mr. Smith, the ship's moving.
Moving fast, too.
Glencannon, have you got the throttle wide open?
She's got the quarter open, sir. Are we moving?
We certainly are. Open it wide, as wide as it'll go.
Why, this is amazing. We must be doing 10 knots or more. What's the meaning of this? I say, Smith, what have you done? Well, this is the fastest a ship ever steamed. Amazing. Simply amazing. But what have you done?
The mystery was soon recognized for what it was. An amazing stroke of luck. Russell and his predecessors had all been on the wrong track. A ship cannot be propelled efficiently by an Archimedes screw. But the underwater obstruction that broke off a large part of Pettit Smith's screw converted it into a rough example of the propellers used today and gave his ship the then astonishing speed of 13 knots. Francis Pettit Smith, by luck, had the invention of the modern ship's propeller thrust upon him, so that his was not a discovery reached by intent. It was purely and simply a matter of luck.
In just 1 minute, we shall hear another fascinating true story, that of Charles Martin Hall. In the meantime, we pause to hear this.
Back now to our narrator and cast for the second unusual story in our presentation, A Matter of Luck.
Charles Martin Hall and A Matter of Luck. From the dim days of the Stone Age to our modern streamlined world, mankind has been concerned with the problem of putting its metals to work. And historians tell us that the extent to which a people used metals was, in olden times, a measure of their civilization. However true this may be, no metal has a more interesting story than aluminium. And in the gaining of it from the crude ores of the earth, Lady Luck played the dominant part. Aluminium was discovered in the 18th century by Sir Humphry Davy, the great chemist, who decided very soon that it was useless. For although, in combination with other elements, it forms 1/13 of the earth's land surface, the 18th century knew of no way to obtain it in its pure state. Yes, for very many years it seemed as if Sir Humphry Davy was right. Then in the 19th century, several processes were found by which aluminium could be isolated in its pure state, but in such very small quantities and at such great cost, that until Lady Luck and Charles Hall took a hand, aluminium was 20 times more valuable than gold. Hall was a student at Oberlin College in Wyo in 1885, when his interest was first aroused in aluminium.
Professor, could I have a word with you?
Certainly, Hall. What is it?
It's about this lecture you've just given us on aluminium, sir. It seems a pity that there isn't a process for extracting it in commercial quantities.
Why do you say that?
Well, sir, in the first place, it's so plentiful. When you think that next to oxygen that we breathe, and silicon, aluminium is the most plentiful substance on Earth, it's a pity that it has to cost so much to get hold of a scrap.
I suppose so. Yes, I suppose so.
But then it's so very light. It's lighter than some woods, and it doesn't rust like iron, and it's harder than copper. Why, sir, there must be a million uses for such a metal.
Possibly, my boy, possibly. But you will have to excuse me. Anything further I can let you know, just come to me.
Old hypocrite. Never gets his nose out of books. He hasn't any more interest in aluminium than my Aunt Ethel.
From the day of the lecture on the character and properties of aluminium, Charles Hall was a man with one fixed idea: to find a process for the extraction of the metal that would put it within reach of everyone. And in order to further his ambition, he stayed on at Oberlin College after graduating to take advantage of its laboratory facilities.
Hi, Charlie. Listen, are you going to the university ball tomorrow night?
Well, as a matter of fact, I don't think I can manage it, Pete.
Well, why not?
Well, you know how it is. I don't like going to these parties without the proper clothes, and well, I feel so shabby.
You'll never make enough money for anything while you sit around in a college laboratory trying to make aluminium.
Well, I'm not trying to make it. You can't make something that exists already. I'm merely trying to isolate it cheaply.
Well, how you going? You making any progress?
No, absolutely none.
I thought so. Now, you listen to me, Charlie. I can get you a good job in my father's office, short hours and good pay. What about it?
No, thanks, Pete. It's very good of you, but well, I'm going to stick it out at the college.
But heck, boy, life's passing you by while you hide in the laboratory.
Catch up.
Well, just as you say. But remember, I've only been at work 4 months. And look, a brand new Prince Albert by a New York tailor. And you can't even go to the prom because you don't have anything to wear. Oh, well, that's the way it goes. You work and I'll make money. So long, Charlie. And good luck with the aluminium.
So long, Pete. If I find what I'm after, I'll finish up with more money than the rest of you at Oberlin put together.
And so, young Charles Martin Hall stayed in his laboratory while his friends went their way. But as the months went by, he began to wonder if he were wasting his time trying to achieve success where so many eminent scientists had failed. Then, towards the end of the summer vacation, he decided to take a rest and went to the small town of Thompson, where he was born. But even at home, his obsession with aluminium would not leave him, and it was there that he had his first stroke of luck.
Really, Charles? If you don't stop talking about those experiments of yours, I don't know what I'll do.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mother. Do I bore you?
Bore me? No, it's not that so much, but It's not right for a lad of your age to moon about so.
Oh, I'm not mooning, Mother. Why, you talk as though I was lovesick or something.
I'd like it better if you were. It'd be more natural. Here, you've been home a week and haven't even called on Deborah Martin. And her so sweet on you, too. It's a shame.
Now, listen, Mother. There's nothing wrong with me. It's just that I've got my mind set on what I'm doing. And I'm not going to give up. Not even for Deborah Martin or any other girl.
And why is it so important for you to make aluminium? What's the use of it?
Well, for one thing, you could do your cooking with aluminium pots and pans.
What's wrong with the pots and pans I cook with at present?
Oh, copper's too expensive. Damages too easily. And iron is too heavy and too hard to keep clean.
We women have been getting along all right with copper and iron for I don't know how many years. And I guess we'll get along for a few more.
All right, then. But it would have thousands of other uses, and there'd be a fortune in it.
People don't make fortunes pottering in laboratories, son. Now, come on. Take the gun and the dog and see if you can shoot some rabbits. You look as if you need some fresh air.
No, I thought I might dip into that new book,
now, but... I know best. Out you go. And if you don't want to go shooting, take a walk down to the Glassworks and see old Dan'l Clark. He's always asking after you. Thinks a lot of you, just old Dan'l.
Now, that's a good idea. How is he?
Ask him when you see him. Now, out you get. I've got me work to do.
Hey there, Dan'l. It's me, Charlie Hall.
Why, howdy, child. I haven't seen you since you was back home on vacation.
That's right, Danny. I'm sorry I haven't been to see you before, but I've been busy.
You still studying, son? What are you on to now?
I'm trying to find a way to make cheap aluminium. Still, you don't want to hear about that. Say, what's that you've got in the furnace, Dan'l?
Oh, that's cryolite, son. We use it to make glass. At least the ways it helps.
It seems to melt easily, enough.
Oh, sure. Just shovel it in the furnace and she melts right away. No trouble at all.
Say, that gives me an idea. Cryolite, eh? That's a double fluoride of aluminium.
Ain't nothing but some kind of dirt to me, son.
Yeah, that's what it is, all right. And if it melts as readily as all that, I might just be able to electrolyze it.
What are you talking about, son?
Now, look, Danny, don't mind me. I'm going to rush off home and look up a few things about cryolite. But if I get some pure aluminium... Well, it was you who put the idea into my head. So long.
Back once more at Oberlin College, Paul started a new series of experiments with cryolite, aided by a student named Brady. One day, he took some cryolite and melted it in a crucible.
Now, see here, Brady. This is what we do. We take the aluminium earth. Well, what have we this time, by the way?
Bauxite. Best I could get.
Oh, that's all right. We'll drop some in the hot cryolite and see if it dissolves. Right?
Right. You better stand back. It might fizz. Here we go.
It fizzed all right. What's more, it dissolved like salt in boiling water. Now, we'll just try electrolyzing it.
You still on that electrolysis? Every other scientist who was ever experimenting with aluminium gave it up long ago.
Well, I'm going to try just once more. Now, will you connect up the wires? I'll fix the crucible.
All right. But I still think you're wasting your time.
Now we'll see. At least I'm trying something new. You've got to admit that.
Well, the current's been on half an hour. How long do you want to leave it?
I guess half an hour is long enough. Switch off. Now then. Well, there we go again. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Not one speck of aluminium.
What do you expect?
Oh, I don't know. Could have happened. Look at that electrode. Not an atom on it. Oh, well, where do we go from here? Well,
I don't know about you, Hall, but I'm going to find myself another job. I've wasted enough time.
Look, let's try just once more. Maybe we didn't leave it long enough. Just once more.
Not me. I'm through.
Well, take this crucible, will you, before you go?
No, take it yourself.
For the love of Pete, did you have to knock it out of my hand?
Oh, I'm sorry. Honest, I am. Yeah, I'll clean up the mess.
It's no use being sorry. That was the last clay crucible.
Oh, there's a couple more on the shelf.
Yeah, but they're lined with carbon. Professor Jewett will knock my brains out for this.
Why don't you use one of the carbon crucibles? You won't know the difference. And I'll cover up for you.
All right. We'll try once more. But I only hope the carbon crucible doesn't stop any reaction we might otherwise get.
Using the carbon-lined crucible, Hall repeated his experiment, first melting the cryolite, then dissolving his aluminium ore in it. Soon the electrodes were ready and the current switched on.
Say, Brady, look, there's something happening here. Look at this, it's getting hotter.
Well, for the love of Pete, it's working.
Switch off. I'm going to have a look at the electrodes.
Well, what do you know about that? You've done it at last. Look!
Globules of aluminium. Look at them, Brady. Little bits of aluminium. Why, I found it. I found it!
By a stroke of fortune, Charles Martin Hall had discovered the process by which aluminium is purified to this very day. Electrolysis was the answer, but only in the presence of carbon. And that was the secret which scientists had failed to find in 50 years of research. Hall's fortune was made, and although he spent 3 long years before he succeeded in interesting the industrialists, at last his company was formed. Originally, it was known as the Pittsburgh Reduction Company, but it has grown into the mighty aluminium company of America, known as Alcoa, the largest concern of its kind in the world. That was the luck of it. A chance remark by the foreman of a glass factory, a dropped crucible, and Charles Hall stumbled upon the discovery that has given the world all the cheap aluminium it can use. Hall's discovery was due in part to his own determination, but as you have heard, it was mainly a matter of luck. The two authentic stories of the discovery of the screw propeller and the isolation of pure aluminium were dramatized by Lindsay Hardy from factual research material and were directed by Donovan Joyce. The performers included Grant Taylor, Kevin Gunn, Kevin Brennan, Lou Vernon, Charles McCallum, Alan Trevor, Ethel Gabriel, Douglas Harold, Peter Dunstan, and Norman Blackler. Your narrator was Ward Leopold, who invite you to listen again 1 week from now, same night, time, and station, for a further fascinating half hour of A Matter of Luck, a Donovan Joyce production.